Hello, welcome back to another edition of Sibeline Insight. I'm Gareth Westwood, Head of Global Intelligence, and today I'm delighted to be joined by my co-host, as ever, Sydney Stewart. Sydney, we have a very packed show today. Of course, we're covering a whole range of conflicts and issues around the globe, not least Israel and Hamas. We're, of course, producing regular reporting on this, but we're a couple of weeks in now to the resumption of hostilities. I know there's been various recent calls from US officials on observing humanitarian law. Articles have been written on ceasefires. It's a very moving, dynamic situation, whether we're talking about humanitarian or the military conflict itself, as well as the diplomatic pressures. We're not going to go into it today, but our Middle East team are here. Our crack Middle East team are here in the corner, working on the products as ever. And we're actually producing quite a suite of products now, aren't we?
We are. We're producing our daily Israel alerts, as well as holding bi-weekly webinars, and the links are in the show notes for anybody that's interested.
Perfect. I hazard to say, if we discuss it on the podcast, even if it's out 24 hours later, the situation may well have changed. So please do, though, go to the show notes, sign up. I believe the webinar, you can get on the webinar for free, as you can our Ukraine webinar as well. So please do go and sign up and do get in touch. So on Israel Hamas then, an issue in Yemen. So Houthis were seen to attack commercial shipping. And, this has had quite a substantial reaction. We know that there's been an official announcement from the Houthis that they would target all ships heading to Israel, irrespective of how they're flagged. They've warned, obviously, international shipping companies not to deal with, Israeli ports. There was a French warship targeted on the 9th of December, I believe, in the Red Sea, with two drones that were intercepted. Of course, the US have got a presence and anticipating this. And are we likely to see, you think, an escalation from US forces in the region as a result?
I mean, in the short term, it's unlikely that there's going to be a significant, uptick in the U.S. troop presence in the Middle East or a significant escalation of hostilities. But as we continue to see Iran-backed proxy groups throughout the region, including particularly the Houthis, attacking U.S. military personnel and assets, as well as commercial vessels, it's definitely going to increase tensions vis-a-vis these groups and definitely it will likely yield an uptick in U.S. targeting of Iran-backed groups in Syria and Iraq in particular.
Of course, we have seen that, haven't we? The initial response to Iranian misadventure, in the perceived Iranian misadventure in the region. So you're saying any response from the U.S. is likely to be constrained to Iraq and Syria?
Yes, certainly. I mean, the U.S. will also continue to try to mitigate attacks against commercial vessels in the region, in the Red Sea in particular, with the uptick in attacks against or by Houthi rebels as well. And in this region in particular, it's going to drive up insurance costs for maritime shipping companies.
Real business implications here, as you say, especially for insurance costs, which are likely rocketing up for shipping traversing that region at the moment. So we'll obviously keep a very close eye on that as we do all things of this nature. However, moving on, yet more tension in the South China Sea. We released one of our daily routine analytical updates. And the first report I see here is on the 9th and 10th of December, the Chinese Coast Guard and maritime militia vessels clashed with what looks to be a Philippines flagged boat in the South China Sea. I know you edited this particular report, Sydney. What can you tell us?
So in the South China Sea, tensions have escalated significantly between the Philippines and China. The Philippines forces were conducting a resupply mission of the two soldiers on aboard the Sierra Madre, which is a warship that has been stationed in the Second Thomas Shoal since 1999 to assert the Philippines' territorial claim over that shoal. And then subsequently, there was some sort of skirmish between a couple of vessels, the Philippine Coast Guard and Chinese Coast Guard. Both have alleged that the other rammed the other boat first. But overall, what we're very likely to see is a continuing escalation of these tensions in the South China Sea in the short term. And it's very likely that similar kind of skirmishes could persist And definitely it's going to raise operational and security risks for maritime vessels, including fishing vessels, civilian fishing vessels, and also hydrocarbon activities in the region.
Good time to be in maritime insurance, seemingly. And Sydney, to what extent, you know, is the US relationship with the Philippines playing a part here, or is it simply a territorial move in what China sees as contested borders?
Well, I think in this case, notably, this territorial contestation has been ongoing since at least 1999 and also prior to that. So in this instance, it's not necessarily, you know, the U.S. Having a direct involvement in the escalating tensions, but definitely the Philippines and the U.S. have bolstered their cooperation, including in military ties and also sort of political and economic realms.
Mm-hmm. No, really interesting. And something that we obviously keep a very close eye on. With the increase in tensions between China and the US, as we pointed out in our annual forecast. However, we shall now move on and we will go to Russia. So another snippet from our daily report today as we record this on Monday, the 11th of December. So Russian President Vladimir Putin has announced he will, surprise, surprise, run for a fifth term in the March 2024 presidential election. Do we think this will be close run, or do we think that Putin will get 99.5% of the votes, which will obviously be, you know, well turned out? What are you thinking?
Something of the sort. I know that in years past, there have been reports of deceased Russian nationals having voted in presidential elections. So undoubtedly, there'll be some concerns over the not so free and fair election that will undoubtedly take place in March 2024. Of course, this didn't come as a surprise, but it's also interesting to consider the context of the announcement. It was assessed by our team that the timing of the announcement, which was made during a military award ceremony for Russian soldiers that have fought in Ukraine, it's serving to try to sort of bolster, you know, the relevance of the military support for Putin and his reelection and everything. So that's quite interesting. And in response to Putin's announcement, prominent opposition leader Alexei Navalny has encouraged Russians to vote for any candidate other than Vladimir Putin on the ballot, and has also advocated that Russian citizens seek to persuade at least 10 other Russian citizens to vote for any other candidate in the presidential ballot next year.
I mean, well-intentioned, but that's unlikely to work, right? I mean, no. Vladimir is a shoo-in for this election, as he has been since, you know, well, since he took office.
Certainly, and we've only seen in the past four presidential elections that Putin has been involved in, kind of a subsequent degradation of democratic procedures and norms and oversights as well.
Yeah, it's worrying times for democracy, and maybe, you know, Navalny's well-intentioned call to support anybody else than Putin. What we've seen during the Ukraine war is that Putin is surrounded by folk that are at times even more extreme in their views than him. So I guess be careful what you wish for. However, pretty much a shoo-in. It'll be interesting to see what, you know, civil unrest, if there is any civil unrest that we witness in the population centres, of course, during the initial months, weeks of the Ukraine conflict, civil unrest was pretty effectively dealt with by the security forces. So I don't see this immediately being a path for revolution in Russia. However, our lead Europe and Eurasia analyst might correct me on that. Maybe we'll get him on closer to the election. However, before we get to today's big thing, which we'll talk about everything to do with Venezuela and recent developments there, our Europe and Eurasia desk put out an alert last week highlighting the increased risk of terrorism. Now, the context of this is that the EU Commissioner for Home Affairs, along with German intelligence services, warned last week the increasing risk of Islamist terrorist attacks throughout Europe, and it's the highest it's been in years. I can only assume that is somewhat due to the hostilities in the Middle East and the polarization of thought. In particular, I'm looking at the map here that our Europe team drew up, looking at Sweden, Germany, Belgium, and France being the most elevated in threat, but also the likes of the UK, for example, Austria, Italy. I mean, we've come a long way since the spectaculars that, you know, bestow your country of origin back in 2001. Far more threatener from the lone wolf actor, right? And we've seen a few attacks over the last couple of months as well. You know, do we think this is on the back of specific intelligence, or, you know, are we just getting prepped for what we assess to be an increased risk?
Security and intelligence services have indicated that this is off the back of you know, concrete intelligence. And they've also, I believe, disabled several networks of radicalized individuals in recent weeks. Certainly, this is due to heightened tensions related to the Israel-Hamas war. So in light of that, authorities and our team have also assessed that major holiday festivities in European capitals, particularly in Germany and France and Belgium, as you indicated, are likely to be primary targets for potential further attempted terrorist attacks in the coming year, and particularly in the coming weeks. And moreover, it's also likely that in the medium to long term next year, during the Paris Olympics and also European Football Championship, which is to be held in Germany, that both of these major sporting events will also possibly be targets for further Islamist terror attacks.
Yeah, and we've you know, reignited our event risk assessments that we've started to deliver, and these two events will certainly be the subject of a comprehensive assessment from us. And, you know, I guess I've been talking to some counterparts. Whilst the, you know, mitigations in and around the events themselves are pretty tight these days, you know, especially in the UK, for example, we have the Protect DT legislation, etc., and all of that come from the Manchester bombing. It's those crowds that just gather, ad hoc kind of gatherings in and around the venues that could be most at risk, especially for marauding, you know, marauding gunmen, knife attackers, ramming attacks, etc., as we've seen. So, yeah, really quite a sobering announcement from officials, and obviously something that we'll be keeping a keen eye on. However, Venezuela. On 3rd of December, Venezuelans held a referendum on the territorial dispute regarding Essequibo, a region in Guyana. The government sought certainly to establish some support to engage in more aggressive action, possibly annexation. And they got support from the referendum, but there's probably a lot more to it than that, right? We were talking, you were saying it was not really that well, you know, the turnout wasn't that good, and maybe a little bit of fabrication there from the interested parties as well. And then, of course, you know, this is in the context of the upcoming election next year. Similar to what we've seen recently in Argentina, foreign policy, you know, domestic politics masquerading, right, as foreign policy. So, yeah, what can you tell us about this, Sydney?
Just to add a little bit of detail to the referendum, the referendum sought to reject the jurisdiction of the International Court of Justice over a case that Guyana sent to the court that is supposed to be heard. And it also sought to reject Guyana's territorial claim over the Essequibo, while also supporting the creation of the state of Essequibo of Guyana, which is to be incorporated into Venezuela. So as you said, this is largely due to sort of domestic political concerns ahead of the election. We consider the main driver of the Essequibo campaign to be the internal dynamics between the ruling regime against that of the political opposition party, which was permitted to hold a primary election just a few weeks ago.
So the opposition party were permitted to participate. That's a change, right? On the back of some US sanction lifting?
Indeed. There was a deal brokered between the opposition and the government. In exchange, the US indicated that it would be willing to roll back some of the sanctions targeting the Venezuelan oil and gas sector. And following the deal, following the primary election, the U.S. did indeed lift some of the sanctions, and there was an influx of U.S. investment.
But you're going to say now that the opposition are still in a position to participate, right? And it's going to be a very free and fair election?
Highly unlikely. Just last week, on the 6th of December, Venezuelan authorities detained a prominent opposition figure, Roberto Abdul, who was also instrumental in organizing the opposition's primaries. And they've also issued arrest warrants for many senior campaign staff involved in the primary.
So what are the US going to shut off the taps again after all this investment? Or is it going to be a bit more difficult to renege on the sanction lifting?
In the short term, it's difficult for the U.S. to renege immediately, although if things continue to escalate, it's possible that the U.S. will seek to snap back those sanctions.
Okay, wow. So we've gone from an annexation into electoral politics and then interference in an opposition campaign, right? So in order to shore up support, the ruling party has threatened to annex another sovereign nation, pass another sovereign nation and incorporate it into Venezuela. It's also gone back on its promise in real terms to allow the opposition party to participate in elections through detaining this individual. Meanwhile, the US are hamstrung because they lifted the sanctions because it looked like the Venezuelan government was playing ball, and now it's going to be very difficult to reimpose the sanctions in the short term. Venezuela has therefore played a bit of a blinder in this case. However, what many of our clients are going to be asking is, you know, what is the real prospect of military action here in neighboring Guyana? Are we going to see an attempted annexation, which, you know, could actually turn into a hot military conflict?
So our current assessment indicates that in the short to medium term, it's highly unlikely that there will be a sort of full-scale annexation by force. That being said, it is very likely that the regime in Venezuela will seek to escalate the conflict. This could result in harassment of Guyanese vessels and foreign-owned vessels, including in the oil and civilian fishing sectors. And this will also raise the risk of miscalculation and possible, you know, a possible intensification of conflict along that border region. So incursions and border skirmishes are a realistic possibility. However, any potential military action is likely to commence as a sort of gray zone operation focused on the coast. So we're definitely going to be keeping an eye out for harassment and those border skirmishes. But indeed, an invasion is unlikely.
Well, never a dull moment for those who only thought that Israel and Ukraine, the Ukrainian war were the hot topics. Look no further than our global desks. As ever, thank you so much for keeping us abreast of these developments and joining me on the podcast today. Thank you so much for joining us. I would encourage you to reach out to us at Sibylline to get your copy of our 2024 annual forecast, in which we, you know, divide up the globe into the various risks that could affect you, your organization, and your staff over the coming year. So please do drop us an email. You'll also find links to the various sites in the show notes. But for now, thank you so much for joining us, and we'll see you again on the next edition of Sibylline Insights.